In today's episode, I speak with Scott Kvieten, who is the founder of Casemark, which is an AI tech legal startup. We talk about him building 6 startups overall, launching fast, quick iterations, failing fast. I think it's really, really cool and powerful, this episode. So let's jump right in. So welcome to a new episode of the Digital Economics Podcast. Today I talk with Scott Kvieten, who is the founder of Casemark. Happy to have you here. Can you explain a little bit what Casemark is?
Sure thing. Thanks for having me, Lewis. So Casemark is a relatively new company. We're an artificial intelligence company focused on the legal sector, the legal tech sector specifically. We started it back in June of 2023, and what we're focused on is essentially building what we call the easy button for attorneys that won't get them in trouble. In other words, we're helping them leverage AI to deliver or create work product that they already create today by hand, just to do it more efficiently, more effectively, and hopefully, you know, a little bit better. We know that AI and artificial intelligence itself is going to have a significant impact on the legal space. However, our thoughts on how it's going to disrupt that space, I think, differs from a lot of our competitors. We think there's the ability to help folks transition, you know, easily into this from a crawl, walk, run perspective versus saying, we have this new, you know, tool. All you have to do is change everything about the way that you work. And that's just not how attorneys adopt technology. So we're trying to take a slightly different approach in that sense.
Okay. Can you give like a typical example, like how attorneys use your software for?
For sure. Yeah. So as I mentioned, you know, we started a little over a year and a half ago. And when we kind of dug in, we learned a couple different lessons from attorneys as we built solutions. We learned that one, they really don't like SaaS software. Attorneys are coin operated, and they'd really like their software to be coin operated too. You know, pay for use. And the other one is they really don't know or care about the AI that's behind the scenes. They just know that they need to look at it, they need to understand it, and they want to make it as simple as possible. And so the first sort of easy button that we developed was for a concept or for something here in the US called deposition summaries. And a deposition is a QA sort of process that happens during civil litigation. And the idea is it's a form of Q&A for discovery during the litigation itself. So attorney asks questions of either the plaintiff or the defense, and then they get responses. And those can be anywhere from a day long, an hour long, up to several days long, depending. It's sort of done when it's done, but you only get one chance to do it. As you get close to trial or arbitration, the law firm will actually request these transcripts from the court reporters. The court reporters are the folks who are allowed to actually transcribe these things. And then they immediately internally inside of the firm hand it to a paralegal or an associate, sort of a junior attorney, and say, hey, can you summarize this? So maybe for a case, you have 30 transcripts that are, you know, on average 200 pages long. Well, all of a sudden you have to go through all of that. So if you can have a summary that allows you to quickly find things, inside of that testimony, then that's really, really powerful. And so, that was sort of the first easy button that we built. And since then, we've built things like medical chronologies. In other words, one of the things that you do after depositions and doing that discovery is you learn about the medical history in the case of a personal injury case. And then when you get that medical history, you now have to sort all those files and determine what's a pre-existing condition, what's the current, you know, injury in question, what's the ongoing treatment, just those kinds of things. And it becomes a significant data challenge for these firms. And while there's a lot of solutions out there that have tried to solve these, the real unlock is sort of this generative AI change that we've sort of hit on in the last 2 years with, you know, obviously, you know, ChatGPT and GPT-4.0. But there's a whole host of other solutions that are really, you know, I think changing the landscape of how this is going to affect legal tech. So hopefully that's an example that makes sense for you. And I know that was super long-winded, sorry.
And no, but I mean, like having like a huge bunch of paperwork and a lot of texts and like saying to ChatGPT, like, can you make like a simple version out of it? And then like having like a filter, which is like a good filter for attorneys, makes definitely sense, which probably like is something which you could kind of build yourself within ChatGPT, but probably it would be like really fucking complicated to upload like several documents and say like, okay, use this language and whatever, and like having a clean interface which is accessible by everyone. That sounds like a cool fit for a lot of lawyers. By the way, is there a difference between an attorney and a lawyer? Because in Europe, most people would say lawyer.
The two terms are interchangeable. There's different types. There's, you know, sort of paralegals who are trained as attorneys, or I shouldn't say that. They're trained as being able to understand process around that, but not all paralegals are attorneys. Attorneys here in the U.S., it depends on the state that you're in. Some states actually don't require that you go to law school. Some do. It's a new thing. As long as you pass what's called the bar exam, then you can practice law in that state. And each state is slightly different in how they do it. I think, I want to say California or Texas, one of those states made it so that all you have to do is pass the bar exam now. So it's kind of a big deal because, I mean, if you can study yourself, you don't have to go to law school, which is a little mind-blowing, but at the same time, I kind of understand it. So, yeah.
Okay, learned something new today because I didn't never thought about this, but I know the word attorney, but I always use lawyer. Okay. So as I get it right, like every lawyer is an attorney, but not every attorney is a lawyer.
The term is interchangeable. So every attorney, an attorney and a lawyer is basically the same thing. But when I say paralegal, that's a term that gets. They're sort of administrative folks who are not necessarily attorneys. And then you have associates, which is another term for an attorney or a lawyer. They're junior attorneys. In other words, they just came out of law school. They've probably passed the bar and they can practice law, but they're an associate. In other words, they're a junior attorney. And then you have sort of, you know, attorneys. Then you have partners. You have, you know, there's a whole, I mean, it's a whole caste system. Let's be honest. So, yeah.
Okay, little deep dive into wordings, which I don't know as a German. What I want to talk about a little bit is like the story you had in your life and how you came up with the idea, because I see you have a Web 1, Web 2 background. I wonder how it shaped your approach to business and how did you came up with such an idea, because typically probably like lawyers would have that idea, but probably not the technical knowledge. Can you tell us a little bit about your story?
Yeah, I mean, I think, traditionally, I mean, this is, I think, my sixth company that I've done, and with, you know, varying degrees of success with all of them. I've had a couple wins and a couple fails in there. And I think the most exciting companies to me are ones that take advantage of disruptive technology cycles. In other words, the dot-com boom bust during the turn of the century, sort of Web 2.0 was very, very interesting. One of the most successful companies that we built was right after the iPhone came out. In other words, the iPhone came out and it was a very interesting time because, look, we all had mobile phones in our pockets when the iPhone came along. But when we saw that first iPhone, we realized, oh, this is the device that's actually going to really propel mobile forward. This opportunity to engage with consumers directly in their pocket and have a brand connect directly to a consumer without having to go through any intermediary like the carrier or the cell phone provider was a huge, huge deal. And so that was a huge opportunity there. And so I've always liked to try to like ride those waves. Again, most recently, we obviously had ChatGPT come along. And that was, we said, oh, wow, there's a really interesting, you know, we've had AI for 40 years, but it's really, this is the version that's going to create mainstream adoption.
I'm happy and proud to announce the sponsor of today's episode. Working with startups and tech companies has taught me a big lesson. Finding the right tools for your team can really change your business. That's why I'm excited about Deel, the all-in-one platform for global teams. That's DEEL. Deel makes it simple for companies managing an international team to seamlessly hire, onboard, and pay both global employees and contractors. They handle all of the paperwork, exchange foreign salaries with local ones, and ensure compliance with local regulations. Deel is designed with the needs of a global workforce in mind. Seamless contract signing, easy expense uploads, in-platform time off management, and more. Plus, its customer support team is available 24/7, no matter what time zone. Ready to see how Deel can transform your global workforce operations? Head to deel.com to book a demo today. That's deel.com. Back to the episode.
Why did we pick legal as a vertical? Well, it turns out my wife's an attorney. And she runs a practice here in Oregon. You Oregon, Washington, Idaho, so three states that are adjacent to each other here in the U.S. And she's, you know, she, like a lot of attorneys, had gone to ChatGPT. She asked some questions and got kind of these watered down responses. And she's like, well, I don't think AI is going to be that interesting. And I said, well, I think there's something here just based on kind of my pattern matching on previous disruptive cycles. And so that was the reason that we chose to sort of go into this. And then one of the other sort of mantras or things that we've learned over the years is ship a product and get it in the market as quickly as possible. And the joke internally for us has been, because I have a team that I work with for years on these kinds of things. And our joke is, hey, can we ship something in 30 days? And then can we get it into market and into people's hands? And if it fails and if it's miserable, and it should, you should be embarrassed about that first product that you put out. But if you get signs or people find it and they go, hey, this is interesting, but that's how you know that's a thread that you want to kind of pull on. And so that's what we really focus with. And you know, candidly, last year, we very quickly, when we launched the company, we built a Word add-in and a Chrome extension, mainly because we knew that there were other, you know, players out there that had those solutions that were pretty successful. And we said, well, you know, we could do that too. Let's do that and let's learn some stuff. And so we had gone out and found some open source solutions that we hired those developers, rebranded their open source offering as ours, and were able to launch this in 30 days. And we learned really quickly that attorneys didn't want those, but there were some things in there that we did learn. And again, we wouldn't have learned it if we didn't have product in market and got it up and running. And so that really quick iteration of failing quickly and then moving to the next product, the next product, the next product. And so it took us about 6 months to land on the easy button. And now that's really stuck. And now we have a whole host of these easy buttons across what we call the litigation lifecycle. So from everything from intake all the way to, you know, settlement or even appeal, we have easy buttons for attorneys that ultimately they can sort of stitch together and essentially case mark a matter. That's kind of the direction for where we're headed. We're still early and we really just have a few easy buttons, but that's kind of how we got going, if that answers your question.
Yeah, definitely it does. What's interesting is that you're like a serial entrepreneur and that you're like having that team which you keep. Can you tell me a little bit more about this? Because I think that's quite interesting that you're saying like, okay, I have this stack of A players I like to work with. How did you find them? How is it working that you're so do you do several things then at the same time, or do you build a startup, sell a startup, build a startup, sell a startup? And how does it work with the team?
Yeah, I mean, it kind of depends. So it's always been my co-founder and I, Steven. He's a CTO that I've worked with now since about 2008, 2007, actually, is when we started working together. And he goes out and sort of solves the really difficult, you know, technological problems. If he can't solve the problem, then there isn't a solution to the problem today. And so he's been really good at helping build that side. And then my job is to go out and whether it's raise capital or convince people to buy it. That's been a really good kind of, you know, partnership for us on that front. And then, you know, over the years, we've gotten to work with a lot of different people with the different companies that we've built. And so as we start a new company and we start to get traction, we can sort of, you know, pick the people that we really loved working with and pull them in, depending on what we're focused on. And, you know, currently right now here at Casemark, we have, you know, five other people that work with us at Urban Airship. We have a designer, we have a go-to-market person, we have a salesperson, we have our head of support is over working with us. And so it's actually really fun because, you know, one, we all have we all know how to work together. There's no sort of like figuring out how we're going to do. The challenge is making sure that we're not just applying our playbook that we ran last time. How can we think through, okay, this is a new disruptive technology. How can we take our lessons and apply what we know to this new technology so that we can do more, better, faster, and, you know, effectively more efficient. And you know, we've been able to accomplish with our team of, you know, 8-9 people, what took us 30 people at Urban Airship, you know, a decade ago. Both from a revenue perspective and from a customer perspective and a product perspective, I mean, it's just astounding what you can do with AI. But the concern and what I see in this space right now is a lot of people are raising money or building companies like you did even 10 years ago as a SaaS company. Okay, well, we have to grow our top line. We need to build a big sales and marketing organization. We need to do these. Well, it's actually not what you need to do in a market like this. At least that's my 2 cents on it. Yep.
Is everyone based in Oregon? And how did you find the people?
Let's see here. There's quite a few folks who are in Oregon. our sort of head of ops and go to market. She's actually in Boston, but she was here in Oregon. She worked with us at Urban Airship years ago. And then we have kind of a development team scattered throughout kind of the US, a few folks in Europe. And again, they're all folks that we've worked with previously. So, you know, it's just a good team of folks. Everybody knows everybody. And it's interesting though, because here in Oregon, I was really surprised. I'm actually in our office. We have two offices here. They're on the other side of the wall. We have another office, and it's a co-working space where we can grow or shrink if we want. And I just thought it was really funny that everybody, you know, when we realized we had sort of a quorum of people in Portland, they're like, yeah, we want an office. I want to come in. And I'm like, what? Which is great because it means that, you know, one, people miss that connective, like, you know, connection with other people. And there's conversations that just happen from a product perspective, from a organic discussion perspective that just can't happen on Slack or in Zooms. And I think that's really important. And so I really liked having a critical mass here, especially at this early stage of the company. And so we'll think about that. Yeah, it's great. How do we find the people? I mean, through networks, really, it's folks who, you know, some folks applied for a job years ago and they went through a process. We hired them, got to know them, and really built a rapport. Other folks were just an introduction from a friend of a friend. You know, and really, for me, it's finding those folks that you love to work with, especially at this stage where we're at. This is such a fun stage because it's so early. And to be able to bring in this team that's, you know, worked together before, and to be able to accelerate things as fast as we have is just fun. I mean, this is such a fun time. And we've raised such a small amount of capital. We raised, you know, like $1.7 million back in April. And
US standards, but the small amount.
It's great. I mean, it's absolutely tiny. Yeah. Considering Q3 here in the US was the biggest investment quarter in the history of history as it relates to legal tech. And we didn't raise. Go out and try and raise around because we're just focused on getting our sales motion and delivering to our customers. And we've got money in the bank and we're growing our top line revenue like crazy. And I just want to stay heads down and keep doing that. Cause I think people have raised too much money. I think, you know, Bill Gates said it best, which is we overestimate what'll happen in 2 years and we underestimate what'll happen in 10. And we're in that 2 year window where people have these crazy expectations and you can't raise all that money and not put it to work in short order. You can't just sort of slow roll it. You have to put it to work. And if you can't grow into the valuation that you've set out, well, then you're setting yourself up for failure or having, you know, potentially diminished returns. So it's a tricky balance for sure.
One thing I wondered is that you mentioned it before, Urban Airship was a big deal for you, I think. And can you explain a little bit the story behind it?
Yeah, I mean, Urban Airship was the same thing. The iPhone had come out in 2007, I want to say, 2008. So I can't remember exactly. I should know that date. We were, you know, there was a group of us, you know, my co-founder and I, and then we had two other co-founders in Urban Airship. We were in between gigs. The company we'd worked at had folded. It was the height of the financial crisis here in the U.S. back in 2009. And the team, we just said, well, what do we want to do? Do we want to build an agency building basically iPhone apps, or do we want to go out and build some products? And I said, well, I want to make money when we sleep. And my co-founder Steven, who's my CTO now, and we've worked together obviously since 2007. He said, well, hey, there's this new thing coming out from Apple called push notifications. And I think it's kind of interesting because app developers don't know how to stand up like a cloud service to be able to basically manage that. They can build apps that get installed on devices, but they're not good at managing cloud services. I was like, oh, well, that's our company. That's what we're going to do. And he's like, no, that's not a company. I was like, yeah, it's a company. Let's just do that. And that was early May of 2009. And I knew that there was a WWDC coming up, which is the big worldwide developer conference in June. And so I said, okay, guys, 30 days, let's ship our product and be live when Steve Jobs gets up on stage and announces push notifications. And they're like, that's crazy, but okay, let's do it. So they went heads down, started building the product. I went out and tried to convince people that we were going to be interesting and compelling, even though like we weren't allowed to talk about anything because we were under NDA with Apple, like all developers. So as we're getting close to WWDC, I was like, oh my gosh, these guys are going to ship this thing. I don't have any customers. So I flew down to San Francisco. They have the event at Moscone Center. It's a big conference center right in downtown San Francisco. And I just kind of said, okay, well, let's try and figure this out. I didn't have a ticket. I thought maybe there'd be places, ways I could sneak in or something, you know? And so I ran into somebody on the plane. He said, oh yeah, you can't sneak in. This is like a really hard event to get into. He's like, well, why don't you go check out the line before the keynote? I was like, what are you talking about? He said, well, it's festival seating for the keynote, which was, you know, lovingly called the Steve Node because it was, you know, Steve Jobs did it. And basically the doors open at 9 a.m. and then the event starts at 10 a.m. So the idea is that 9 a.m. when the doors open, people go run in and grab seats. So your line, your place in line matters. So people start lining up the night before. And I was like, oh, great. You mean there'll be a couple thousand people standing there waiting to go in? What a perfect target audience. So I went to Costco, which is a big like discount marketplace. I bought like $1,500 worth of donuts and danishes. And I took a cab and I showed up at the Moscone Center around 4:30 in the morning, something like that. It was still dark. There were 2,000 people in line. And I just started talking to people. I had a little card I printed out that says, we help with push notifications. You know, we're here to help you, blah, blah, blah. And so I sat in that line for 5 hours, talked. I went all the way through. I don't know how many people I talked to, but then the doors opened at 10 a.m. or at 9 a.m. Everybody went inside and I was like, okay, I guess that's it. And while I'm in line, I hear about three or potentially four other competitors who were going to do the same thing because everybody knew this was coming out. Everybody knew there was an opportunity here. And I was freaked out because I was like, oh God, what does this mean? Like we're screwed because we're not funded. We don't have a beautiful website, any of this kind of stuff. Well, Steve Jobs got up on stage and he announced normally. So that was June. Normally they say, okay, cool. We're going to launch this thing in September. And so we figured, oh, we have 3 months to like polish everything, but you know, hey, we have a working prototype. We hit our 30 days. That's great. Well, instead what he said is, oh, this isn't going to be available in September. This is going to be available in 7 days. And all of a sudden, we were like, oh my gosh, 7 days. And so sure enough, we went out and told everybody, we're ready, take all comers. And sure enough, we ended up landing the largest app developer in the App Store because they wanted to be the first one with push notifications. They didn't have the ability to do it. All of those competitors that I mentioned before, they had beautiful websites, they had funding, they even threw parties that night. But they just had a big thing that said, enter your email and we'll let you know when the product's ready. We had a product that was ready and shipped, and that 60-day difference of us being live in market before everyone else shipped meant we won the market, and we became the premier player in that space, and ended up, you know, landing a bunch of customers, ended up raising $50 million in venture for that business, you know, scaled it to even north of $100 million in revenue now. Anyway, so a super long answer to your question: how do we start Urban Airship? But to me, it's a testament to like, ship something, ship it quickly, and then iterate as fast as you can because you never know what's going to happen. You might get lucky like we did with, you know, instead of the 3 months, having 7 days. That turned out to be a blessing for us. So I'll take it.
Do you think that's the number one thing for building a startup? So like launching fast, quick iterations, failing fast, being the first one on the market if possible, and like going out even if it's not pixel perfect and built like trash, and looking like trash. But if it's working, people will be using it.
So I think there's three things that you have to align when you're starting a company. It's team, tech, and timing. Team and tech are pretty easy to pull together, depending on your network and you know your ability to find people who can do the technical piece. The timing part's what's really hard. In other words, can you ride some timing in the market that is because of some technological advance, some new paradigm that allows people to do something they couldn't do before? Or more importantly, you know, it's those two elements, especially as they apply to sort of traditional businesses, that have a huge, profound effect. I mean, for us with Urban Airship, we were able to do push notifications better than anybody else. So in other words, the right message to the right person at the right place at the right time. Well, that was really important for brands. And so they came to us because they needed a partner to be able to deliver that. Now law firms are asking the same thing. They're like, uh-oh, how do we do AI? So they're coming to us because one, we give them the guarantee around security and privacy. But more importantly, we're framing this as, look, we're going to be a partner with you as you navigate this disruptive cycle we don't have all the answers today, but we're going to do this together. And by doing that and building that relationship, we just find that that's such a better way to go to market. And so anyway, so team, tech, and timing, that's to me the key. And you can't bank on timing. You just have to kind of ride the different waves that are out there, or make your own. Yeah.
So does this also mean if you see like a business idea, but you or a business opportunity on the market, but you see one of the three like not being perfect? So like you have a perfect idea, perfect timing, perfect tech stack, which would be possible, but you don't have the right people accessible, you wouldn't do it? Or if you see, okay, someone else already on the market and I am maybe the second one building this, would you skip that business idea, even if it's like really like a shiny thing to you?
No, I mean, I think the best founders are the ones who don't dig in too deep, in my opinion. In other words, if I had all the information about, you know, building a legal tech company a year and a half ago, I probably wouldn't have started one. Because what I would have learned is that it's really hard to sell into attorneys. It's a wildly competitive space. There's all these people who are invested in it. But instead, you know, it's looking at it instead and thinking about, well, how can you find your way in through this? How can you find a beachhead or a toehold that you can then potentially expand? And then once you get those customers who are like, ooh, this is great, I love it, here's money, and by the way, I have this laundry list of things I want, that's how you know you're sort of onto the product market fit. Ultimately, as a founder or as a CEO, you know, you kind of have three jobs. I think everything kind of comes in threes. One is clearly communicating the vision to both, you know, the team, you know, people you're selling it to and investors. Two is making sure you have the right people on your team to do that. So if you don't have the right people, you have to find those people, however you're going to do it. And then the third one is make sure you never run out of cash. You got to make sure that, you know, your job is to make sure you have the money you need to make the thing go, because it's not about raising money or, you know, having sexy stories in the press or anything like that. It's literally a game of survival. How can you get to the next milestone and the next milestone and the next milestone? And if you have to beg, borrow, or steal to do it, I mean, don't steal. But that's absolutely the critical component there. So at least that's my take on it. Yeah.
Let's talk a little bit about the last part, because I think in Europe, people like most of the times go bootstrapped. And they are a little more shy with getting funding and like reaching out to investors. And I think also investors are like more risk aware and more not taking a big bet, comparable to the United States. But so your idea is saying, okay, you need to make sure that first money, it's a game of survivorship. How do you think about like getting money from investors, and how was your approach during your startups?
Yeah, I mean, the U.S. investment scene, specifically around the Bay Area, is such a weird anomaly, right? You know, the business model of Y Combinator is place as many $500,000 bets as you can, and as long as you get, you know, one or two unicorns a year out of it, there's a business there. Well, guess what? It's not a heck of a way to build a business, you know, and most of those companies fail. And that actually creates quite a bit of, you know, sort of pain in the market, because you have sort of markets that are inflated by this capital and people go to buy customers. And, you know, arguably it does some bad things. Like here in the US, you know, Uber was able to subsidize their service early on with essentially free money, because money was so inexpensive. Raise. Same thing with Airbnb. And then once they've dominated the market, they turn around and they crank up their prices. So is that good for the market? Ultimately, I don't know. That's a little tricky there. From an investment standpoint, look, unfortunately, I think a lot of investors, I've learned that investors tend to invest off their previous playbook. In other words, if they were successful in SaaS, they want a pattern match on SaaS. The problem is good founders see new patterns that investors don't. And the biggest concern I always have, and I've learned this lesson too, because I remember walking into a partner meeting and talking about the total addressable market for push notifications, then walking out of that partner meeting and having the partner who brought me in say he couldn't believe how I embarrassed him by coming up with a number like $1.1 billion in 5 years for this market. He's like, that's just crazy. And sure enough, I was crazy because I was off. The market was actually $3 billion in 5 years. And so I didn't listen to myself in that case. And so I think founders start to hear what investors tell them. And then they think, oh God, I have to change my pitch to that. No. Your only job is to deliver products that customers want to buy and want to buy more of because they're saying, hey, I need this plus. And if you get that, investors will come and they'll come later, but they'll show up. As long as you get product market fit, that's the key. And product market fit is when you are absolutely slammed. You have no time in the day because you have so many, your phone's ringing off the hook. Emails are coming in, support challenges. People can't pay you because they're having a hard time using Stripe or whatever it is. Like, that's called product market fit. And once you hit that, that's how you know, the investment story takes care of itself. So focus on getting to that piece and then you can figure out everything else.
Okay. Yeah. That's really exciting. In general, because you were mentioning Y Combinator, what's your opinion about Y Combinator?
I mean, it's interesting. I mean, it's funny because we had some Y Combinator companies as they were getting close in August reach out to us. And they're like, hey, you seem to be really successful at what you guys are doing. Like, who are your customers? How are you guys selling to them? And I'm like, why am I telling you this? I'm competing with you. Like, why on earth would you? I thought that was a weird playbook. But, you know, whatever. Maybe it works for them. I don't know. Look, the whether I like it or not, the Y Combinator model works for a couple of different things. One is, you know, the way that they place their bets and the way that they sort of, you know, force these cohorts through is actually really impressive. And then there's also the network effects that, you know, over 50% of the revenue for any of the YC companies that raise either a seed or a series A, that 50% of that revenue is coming from other YC companies. That's actually really powerful, whether we like it or not. And that's a market signal for, you know, other investors because, you know, they nobody wants to go out on a limb because some crazy founder told them something. You know, if you can, there's sort of safety in networks, as it were. And so, look, I'm a fan of Y Combinator. I'm a huge fan of Paul Graham. I mean, he's so well-spoken and he, you know, even those essays from, you know, what feels like 10,000 years ago are so poignant and so relevant today. It's like people don't remember that history repeats itself, or it may not repeat itself, but it definitely rhymes. And I think people forget about that. So, yeah.
Yeah, and I think, so I'm personally so fucking thankful for the Y Combinator library, because I even if I have been to a university in Germany, and I think we have a good university system, I think you don't really learn anything about startups, even if you're interested into economics. And I think they have like the best of the best people talking about that stuff. And it's just free on YouTube and everyone can watch it who wants to learn something about that stuff. Yeah. Cool place for Y Combinator sphere. So coming back to Casebark, I wonder, how do you think are legal professionals reacting to AI and to the stuff you're building? Are people worried about your company and being jobless and that kind of things?
No, I don't think, you know, there's definitely the mainstream media that hypes up the, you know, reduced headcount, the hallucinations, all those kinds of things. Instead, what we focus on is how can this sort of, you know, turn paralegals into super paralegals? How can we make it so that an attorney can go from managing 75 or 100 cases to managing 300 cases? That's good for a firm. And then I think the other thing that people don't think about or aren't really mapping into their sort of predictions about how the effects of AI on the legal industry is, look, AI is going to make it really, really easy to litigate, whether we like it or not. And what that means is we're about to enter into a phase where there's going to be 5 to 10x the amount of litigation that we had previously. And what that means is whether you're on the defense or the plaintiff side, you're going to need tools to be able to manage more of those cases. You can't make new attorneys fast enough or new paralegals fast enough. So my sense is that those folks are going to be, especially ones who can navigate these tools to be able to handle more cases, those are going to be the ones who command, you know, significant increases in pay and, you know, based on their performance. And so to me, I think we're about to enter the golden age of legal. I'm far more optimistic. I think that's probably because I'm a founder. And so I lean hard into that. The other thing for us is I don't go out and try and sell our products. we drive customers who have intent, and then when they find us and they start to use our solutions, we make sure that they stay with us and that they're sticky, and that we deliver more things that they might want that are adjacent to the product that they came in on. And that becomes a really powerful mechanism. If I try to spend time sort of convincing people to buy my stuff, then I'm wasting time with someone who's ready to buy. So that's kind of how we've framed it. And, you know, so far it's going really well. So, yeah. Mm-hmm,
mm-hmm. One last big question. What's CaseMark's future? What is your vision? Where do you want to be in a few years?
Yeah, I think where we're headed is ultimately we want to be the first place that attorneys go when they think about taking on a new case. In other words, we want folks to go, we need to CaseMark that first. We want us to point CaseMark at, you know, the file folder that has the pleadings, the transcripts, the medical records, the police reports, the tax returns. And then we service a series of sort of next best actions for them. They allow them to kind of dig in and figure out what they need to be able to do. The key there is being able to still deliver those work products that they're used to using and that folks who haven't made the leap to AI still need. So it's this sort of straddling the old and bringing in the new, and knowing that over time that transition will sort of blend into a new world order. But it doesn't happen. You don't go from zero to AI overnight. It just doesn't happen that way. And so we believe that we can actually shape how this works, and then bring a lot of folks along with us to be able to sort of share in what I think, you know, AI is going to do for everybody. So, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And will we see CaseMark in Europe and Germany at some point?
It's a great question. It's still early for us. I mean, North America is just so huge for personal injury, and that's what we've been focused on. We definitely will look at, you know, the UK, EU as a whole at some point. Ideally, what I'd like to do is back into it through acquisition. That's what we did at Urban Airship. We were able to sort of back into Europe, back into San Francisco with a couple different acquisitions. It's just a better way to do it. But again, it just depends on if the market, you know, what the market will bear. So,
okay, exciting times ahead. Thank you so much for joining today my podcast. I mean, I will watch you on LinkedIn, etc. Wish you all the best. And thank you so much for giving all these insights on building startups today.
That's awesome. I appreciate you having me on, Lewis, and great to connect. And I look forward to following you as well.
Thank you so much for listening today to the episode. I hope you learned something. I definitely did. If you like the episode, give it a like, give it 5 stars, share it with friends, and subscribe. Whatever you can do makes me happy. Thank you so much. See you next time. Bye-bye.